Good morning, everyone. It is an honor and an incredible treat to share this time with you. It's, I guess, the most important thing is it's my profound and heartfelt prayer and blessing that God should keep each one of you safe and healthy and watch over your families and all of the Jewish people and the entire world, everybody who is in a difficult spot. God should protect them. God should give a healing and a speedy recovery to all those who are ill. Many of the people on this call, we know people who are affected by the current virus. And I look forward to getting together under more, I guess we could say, normal circumstances. I'll just introduce myself for a moment as a special participant in this group, because over the past 5 years, thanks to the dedicated efforts of the museum, and a special shout out to Kelly and to Amanda and now to Wendy and the whole museum team for having welcomed me over the past 5 years to participate in a beautiful study group that has been steadily growing with members and participation of just the most extraordinary people. And that's you fellows who have devoted your time, your energies, and your talents to sharing the story of the museum, the Holocaust Museum here in Illinois, with the greater Illinois community and even beyond, people who come from all over the place. So the work that you're doing is extraordinary, and the opportunity to participate has been beautiful. I'm here in Chicago for the past 12 years, although right now physically I am in my special basement office in Skokie, Illinois, not far from some of you. I came to Chicago a dozen years ago as part of an educational enterprise that we call the Yeshiva University Torah Mitzion Kollel of Chicago. Now, that's quite a mouthful for some of you. Even for me, it takes on a good day. It takes like a couple tries. But this kollel means collective. So we have a group of rabbis who got together and moved to Chicago to share educational resources, to share learning with the community. And then this has just mushroomed over the years to include a women's institute that we call Neely, and then an effort, and that's part of why we're here today, called the Midwest Center for Jewish Learning. The Midwest Center for Jewish Learning is our broader community outreach educational vehicle. So under this umbrella that we call the MCJL, the Midwest Center for Jewish Learning, we offer lots of different learning opportunities and partnerships with other important institutions in our community. So for example, the JCCs of Chicago has a tremendous facilities and wonderful staff, and when they're looking for educational Jewish content, so they reach out to us and we offer classes both for their staff and their constituents. We offer classes not just in the museum, but in people's homes and with other partner institutions. So over the last couple of years, thanks to a couple of docents, and I think I see Cecilia here. She's probably hiding. I saw somewhere. Where is Cecilia? There she is. Hi, Cecilia. Thanks to a group of docents, we started about 5 years ago a small study group, and we meet about every 4 or 6 weeks in the bottom of the museum, downstairs in one of those very bright, you know, early childhood type classrooms. You know, the ones with the gray walls and the gray ceilings and the gray fixtures. That's where we get together. And we discuss spiritual resistance. And so today, I'm delighted and honored, and thank you again to the museum team, for expanding this opportunity beyond our docent study group. And by the way, if any of you who have not participated yet would like to join, you're all more than welcome. I do see a couple of repeat offenders from our regular classes here, whether you can see them on the screen or not. Shale Siegel, you can't hide. We know you're out there. So we are always welcoming new folks. So if anybody wants to join, you're more than welcome. Let's begin thinking about the theme for this season, from a Jewish perspective, and how that's going to relate to the concept of spiritual resistance, which is the theme that we're going to talk about today with a specific focus. And that is that we are just on the cusp, getting ready in the Jewish community, and many of us on this call, we're getting ready for Passover, or what we call Pesach, which is the Hebrew term. So Pesach, if you were to ask a child, let's say in the in the day school system, they would tell you that one of the names, one of the terms with which we refer to this period, this holiday, is Zman Chirutenu, the time of our freedom. And when we think about the Holocaust and we study Holocaust literature and the experience of the Holocaust, this idea of slavery and freedom is obviously a core component of the conversation. So what we want to think about today together a little bit is, for the just the first starters, how do we define freedom? How do we define freedom? So I would say one of the most amazing, fantastic definitions of freedom comes to us from a rabbi, a rabbinic figure who I'd like to introduce to you. His name is Rabbi Abraham Isaac HaKohen Cook. Rabbi Cook was the first chief rabbi of the modern settlement, the modern state, pre-state of Israel. He died in 1935. And Rav Cook was a crucial figure in transforming the modern world as its understanding of Judaism and the land of Israel. So I'll just pull it up right now, one second. I'm going to share with you. Now we're going to start kicking in the screen share. So if you can't see the screen, you'll send a little comment on the side. So what you're looking at now, this is a picture of Rav Cook when he was younger. If you go to Israel today, you will actually see this building. It's on Rehov HaRav Cook. This is Rav Cook's house. You can go visit it. They have a tour. It's really a beautiful type of museum. On the bottom here, you see this is a picture of Rav Cook when he was older. I'll zoom in a little bit. This is his handwriting from a letter on the right side. He was born in 1865, dies in 1935. Hang on, I'll zoom in a little so you can see it better. He comes to Israel in 1904. Now you can see a little better, I think, right? He comes to Israel in 1904. He becomes the chief rabbi in 1921. He founds the yeshiva in 1924. So Rav Cook is a very important, fundamental personality. This is the outline that I was trying to send to you. We're going to email it to you later. So this is a great picture of Rav Cook. If you can see, it's a little hard to see because it's in the background. You actually see a photograph of Rav Cook with a 1920, 1915 automobile standing behind him. We're going to define freedom from Rav Cook. Now, can you see it now? Yes, right? Okay. So Rav Cook, and I'm going to introduce you this section of my library on the back, this entire shelf and the shelf below it, you see like a series of whitish-yellowish books. All of those yellowish books, all of them are authored by Rav Cook. He wrote dozens of books and many, many articles. Rav Cook has the following amazing definition of freedom, and it's perfect for us to think about today. He says, Rav Cook explains that freedom is the ability to be true to yourself. That is the definition of freedom. A person who is coerced into doing something which is not in consonance with their inner self is not free. And that could be because they are being physically coerced, or it because they're being emotionally or socially coerced. If you have somebody who is in a vocation, in a job, that doesn't really speak to them, that they don't want to be doing, they want to do something else. According to Jewish law, the Talmud teaches that that person has the legal right to leave that job in the middle of the day, right in the middle of their work. Now, they have to figure out how to make sure that nothing falls apart, who's going to pay for the next plumber to come or the next painter. But if you're pursuing something that doesn't speak to your inner voice, you can always pursue your voice. Why? Because the Talmud says that we are servants of God and not servants of anybody else. If somebody, let's say somebody really, really in their heart of hearts, they feel that their calling in life is to be a dentist. And then when they go to college, somebody tells them in their academic advisement, you shouldn't be a dentist, you should be an accountant, or you should go into finance. And they're like, okay, society tells me I should go into finance. Well, then they're not really being true to themselves. Being true to yourselves is following what and who you are internally. If society tells us that the only things that matter are A, B, and C, but something internally tells me that D, E, and F are really the things that are true to me and they are essential to my understanding of self, so that is being free, is being true to yourself. Rabbi Cook points out, therefore, that what is our true essential self? It's our soul. Every human being is endowed in the image and the spirit of God. And therefore, each one of us has a soul, which is our essential self. Because our physical self, our corporeal self, some of you are looking at me and saying, well, he has very dark hair. The truth is, if you looked closely, when I got to Chicago, my hair was really dark. Now it's not so dark, but it looks better on the screen. Does that mean that myself has changed? Because now I put on a few pounds, maybe my hair is changing, I have hair, I don't have hair. The answer is that's not my essential self. Of course, my essential self is that ball of emotions and feelings and experiences and awareness, that entire mental and emotional psychological identity, that's really the expression of the soul. That soul is the essential self. So now we can understand that to be truly free, the theme of Passover, the idea of being free, is being ourselves. And that's why Viktor Frankl, when he talks about how he and others coped and dealt with the experience in the Holocaust, he said, you know what they couldn't take away? The Germans, the Nazis, they could not take away the last of the human freedoms, which is to choose one's own way. That they could never take away. They could force Jews to do a lot of things. They could force their victims to work for them and to be slaves to them. But at the end of the day, they can't take away how each of us internally goes about our life, how we think about life, how we are oriented in life. That, Viktor Frankl says, nobody could take away from the Jewish people. And that's why when we think about spiritual life in the Holocaust, it's not across the board, it's not everybody, but there are so many instances where we find spiritual resistance, meaning the Germans sought to break not just the Jewish physical body, not just to annihilate Jews one at a time with bullets and then with gas, they sought to break their spiritual identity, which is why in so many cases they desecrated spiritual objects, objects of religious significance, because those have some value in terms of Jewish identity, of Jewish spiritual core. So in many places, as you all well know, some of you know this and talk about this on your tours when you get to Kristallnacht, in that section of the museum, places where Germans came into towns and they opened up the Ark and they took out the Torah scrolls. And you'll excuse me, some of them, they put them on the floor and had rabbis spit on them or step on them. That's not a physical oppression, that's a spiritual oppression, trying to take away the components of value that mean something to a Jewish community. But so many Jews would not allow that to happen. And despite the servitude, they remained free. What does it mean they remained free? They weren't free, they were shackled. They were free in the Viktor Frankl sense, is that they were free to maintain their identity. That before the Germans walked into their town, they had a tradition. This is how their mother taught them to comport themselves. This is how their father taught them to live their life. That's something that they could still maintain to whatever extent they did. And that's one expression of spiritual resistance. To resist the Nazi occupation, not physically, although some did. We are focused today and during the last five, six years, in our journey of exploring case studies, insights, episodes where Jews expressed resistance spiritually, to express their freedom of saying that you, the Germans, the occupiers, you can't take away our internal identity, our tradition, our sense of self, and our religious self. So I want to give you three examples in the Passover context of how Jews, I'll give you three examples of Jews who observed Passover. To whatever extent they did, they observed Passover even in the most unimaginable conditions. And their commitment to this is an expression of spiritual resistance. To be able to stand up and say, irrespective of what's going on here, I'm going to stay true to my tradition and to my roots. So let me take you to one place first. This is a fan favorite. Here we go. Let's go here. I want to take you to a book which I hope you can see in front of you. This is called The Holocaust Jewish Calendars, Keeping Time Sacred. This is written by Alan Rosen. For those who came to this discussion, we had a whole session where we talked about Jewish calendars and Jewish times, and we used an article from Alan Rosen. This is the new book that he published this year. Okay, it's an academic book. You see, I'm showing it to you on Amazon because it's $77 online. If you can afford that, you know, we have the opportunity to buy it here, or you can also donate that $77 to some needy cause like the Ark or the Chicago Chesed Fund, and we'll save the book for another time. So the good news is you don't have to spend $77 because you can get a little piece here online. I can also give you an article which quotes some of this later. This is an amazing insight, this book, talking about how several Jews kept a calendar. And so we have several examples of Jewish calendars that were kept during the Holocaust. Now, keeping a calendar is very significant for Jewish people because that is not just about how we mark the days, but we sanctify time. And Jews are very conscious of time in terms of festivals and the Sabbath and all of this kind of stuff. So one of the calendars that we've talked about, and some of the members of this group I see online have used this in their tour, we talk about a woman, a young woman by the name of Sophie Solberg. Sophie Solberg was a girl, a young woman who grew up in Germany, and in the 1940s, 1941 to 1943, she went to a camp of Hachshara, which was a Zionist camp devoted to training people for going and ultimately to live and settle in Israel. And she met a group, she had another group of Jewish religious girls in this Hachshara camp. And one of the things that they learned in this Jewish context that she knew how to do was, and this is something that's amazing because I don't think I could do this, she knew how to build, construct, and write a Jewish calendar, which she later did when she worked in a laundromat in Auschwitz. So we actually have a calendar from Sophie Solberg, which I'm not going to show you a copy of it because I want to focus on this. This specific point. So Sophie Solberg gets to Auschwitz, she gets put in a laundromat, and she actually makes a little paper calendar, which is phenomenal. But on the way there, Alan Rosen points out, if you see here in the book, Passover 5703, April 19th, 1943, which is the same day of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. Sophie Solberg is deported to Auschwitz. And look what it writes. Sophie and other deportees who had baked matzah while still in Neuendorf lived according to a different calendar, the Jewish calendar, conducting a Passover Seder in the railway car or animal wagon, as she called it, without windows. First Pesach Seder we're going to visit, if you could just imagine such a thing, sitting in a rail car with Sophie Solberg, and there was actually another woman who corroborated in the footnotes, he quotes, there is another person who also made a Passover Seder in the car. So if you can imagine, you're in the permanent exhibit now, you're going up the ramp before you get to the depth camps down the stairs, you're standing in that car, 80 to 100 people, everyone's packed in there, and there are a couple of Jewish girls making a Passover Seder during the deportation in the rail car. Incredible. That's story number one. Story number two, we're going to come to him later a little bit. You'll see from the section I'll show you. There was a man, he became, Sophie Solberg survived the war and donated her calendar, which is how we have a picture of it now. Second story is from Rabbi Yehoshua Aronson. He wrote a book in Hebrew called Alei Meroros, Bitter Herbs, where he talks about his experience in the war. He spent a period of time in Buna and Auschwitz, but before that, he was in a work camp called Kunin. When he was in Kunin, they were in a barrack where he says they observed a Seder. So they had no matzah, they had no maror, but they sat around and they recited the Haggadah from memory. And there are many other examples of Sedarim in a work camp. And then the third example that I wanted to share with you comes from this story. You can find this. There's a story collection put together by the Azrieli Foundation. Here you have it. You see it on the screen from this man by the name of Michael Kutz, who was in a partisan group. So you have Jews experiencing the Seder on a train, in a work camp, and in a partisan group in the forest. And he describes how they were, it's April of 1942, a bunch of Jews, including a guy by the name of Moshe Abramowitz, who was one of the Jews who had escaped from Bobruisk, brought a small prayer book, and they realized that they have to make a Pesach Seder. So what did they do? This guy, Moshe Abramowitz, got some beets. And instead of having wine, they had a red soup. They got some horseradish, and on the first night of Seder, he says, since he was the youngest, this Michael Kutz, he was the youngest, he was going to say the Manishtana. After the tears fell from our eyes, after this, we continued to keep the traditions of all the Jewish holidays, which gave us the courage and the will to survive. With God's help, we would eventually live in this world as free people. So Jews, before, during, and during the camps, and even in the partisans, Jews are out there, and they are observing Passover to whatever extent, even if it means using beet soup instead of wine. That is a spiritual connection to the previous life that they had. If you think about it in terms of where the museum begins in the permanent exhibit with the life before, that was the rootedness for these Jews. So many of them came from Orthodox, observant, traditional homes, and even though their life was destroyed, their world was destroyed, they were able to continue to hold on to a piece of that and to continue it despite any circumstances. So that is a form of internal spiritual resistance in the observance of Passover. Any questions, comments, or observations before we go to Haggadahs? If you have questions, just type them into the chat. I'll open the chat now so I can see. All right. Wendy, you'll keep an eye on that. Okay, so I want to move now from observances of Passover to examples, practical, physical examples of spiritual resistance, and that is the creation of Haggadahs. I want to turn your attention now to the screen. I'm going to share with you something from Yad Vashem. This is really amazing. Yad Vashem has a, you see on the website, that has an artifact. Can you see it there? This is a, it's coming up. That's, there you have it. This is a hand-drawn Passover Haggadah used at the Seder by the inmates of the Gurs camp. Gurs is a camp in southern France. It was a transit and internment camp where Jews were held, and you see it's not just written, it also is illuminated. This is the last page of the Haggadah, and it contains a dedication to one of the rabbis who was there, Rabbi Ansbacher. You see it has, if you could see on the screen, it has German and French and Hebrew on the bottom, Poseach es yadecha umasbia. This is the end of the Haggadah that you're looking for it. This is a page from the Haggadah. On the right side is the last page of the text, which is in Hebrew. This is from the section of the end of the Haggadah. Chasal Sidur Pesach Kil Chaso. Some of us sing that at their Seder. Chasal Sidur Pesach. You can imagine they were doing the same thing. And then it is typed in Latin letters. On the left side, it is what we call transliterated. And this is Rabbi Leo Ansbacher, who was in the camp from 1941 to 1942. You can find this in the Yad Vashem archives. Amazing. So they actually wrote this Haggadah in the camp. Let me show you another Haggadah. Second Haggadah that I want to introduce you to. And this Haggadah is called the Beis Aaron Haggadah. Actually, let me open this version. Here we go. Hold on. Here we go. Can you see this drawing on your screen? Can you just give me a thumbs up if you can see it? Can somebody see the picture of the Haggadah on your screen? Dina, you don't see it yet. You see a picture of something that says Haggadah Shel Pesach in Hebrew? Okay, great. So let me, hold on. Great, thank you. Got it. Now do you see it? Great, thank you. Okay, so this is an amazing thing. There was a chassid, a Belzer chassid, whose name was Rabbi Aaron Friedman. This man was a disciple of the Belzer Rebbe. Their family were business people. They weren't rabbis. He wasn't a rabbi. I'm going to make it a little bit bigger. Does this look like a printed Haggadah? No. This is his handwritten cover of the Haggadah that he wrote of his own. This is a business person. Avram Aaron Ben, you see on the bottom, his last name was Friedman. That's his handwriting. And now this is how, imagine you were going to illustrate your own Haggadah. Can you see this? Sefer, the book, Beis Aaron. His name was Avram Aaron of the Haggadah Shel Pesach. He wrote four commentaries, Aleph, Beis, Gimel, Dalet, four different styles of commentary on the Haggadah. He wrote this all by hand. And you see, each one of these has a different name. Each one of these commentaries, he has one, two, three, four, and then a fifth one of stories. This is a commentary, this is a Haggadah that this man wrote and kept during the Holocaust. He has, it's like, we could do an entire session just on this one Haggadah. If you can imagine that somebody, during the war, wrote this Haggadah and then kept it with them. He worked in several labor camps. In the text of the commentary of the Haggadah that he wrote, he describes some of his family story. You know where it is? Where, if you go down here, if you see on the page, you see where there's a little arrow? Dina, you give me a thumbs up, you see the arrow? Yeah. So this is a page of the printed edition of the Haggadah that we have. This tells you the story because at the end of the blessings of what we call Birkat HaMazon, which is the grace after the meals when we thank God for our food, there is a section where we say God should bless our parents. Harachaman, the merciful one, hu yivarech es avi mori. So I say this every time I have bread. When I finish eating, I say the Birkas HaMazon, I bless my parents, my in-laws, my wife, my children. So he says, in this section, in the Haggadah, I have to tell you something about my parents. All the things that happened to my parents in 1941 after Pesach, he describes his own, he says, I was taken to a work camp. And I, for 4 months, and I had to wear the garb of a slave. And I had to work for 4 months, terrible backbreaking work. And then he tells you the exact dates where my father was, and my father died in this and this time. And then they took me back. This is all in his commentary on the Haggadah. He kept this with him until almost the end of the war, and then he hands it over to a family member. It survives the war, but he does not. But could you imagine, this was his life's work, and this is the only thing we have as a memorial for this man. One businessman. This businessman who this made it his life work that he wanted to make sure that he had a Haggadah. Who would have thought? But the story of the Haggadah is the story of the triumph of survival, of the fact that Jews are going to be redeemed. And the fact that he held on to this Haggadah, this Passover document, and gave it to a family member, a daughter of his, who gave it to somebody else, it's because he believed in the eternal vision of the Jewish people, that even though the Germans weren't going to kill them today, but tomorrow there will be Jews who will survive. Could you imagine having that kind of faith and hope to hold on to your own personal Haggadah? So what you are looking at, and it's just extraordinary, you are looking on the screen at this man's handwriting illustrations of his own Haggadah, how he wrote Beis Aaron, Beis Avram. This is Haggadah number two. Haggadah number three, let's get this one, is the Scheinzen Haggadah. Hold on. No, hold on. Here we go. Can you see this, the circle? Everybody can see that circle with the A in it? Okay. So we're going to do a pop quiz now. Pop quiz. What is the circle with the A in it? I'm going to watch on the chat. Who knows? What is that circle? It's actually black and white, but if it's not black and white, it's in three colors. quick pop quiz, write it in on the side. If you go to the button on the side, there's a thing on the bottom that says chat. Write it in on the chat. What is the circles, those three circles with the A in the middle of it? Sharon, I see you're raising your hand. Type it in there. Army, yes. Army, yes. Which army? Anybody know? Let's see. American Army. Yes, it is the American Army. So here is the... I'm going to show it to you right now. Screen share. If you go... One second. Here we go. Google search. U.S. American Third Army. It's referred to as the Third Army. A-R-C-E-N-T. So this is the logo of the American Third Army under the command of General Patton. So why is it that I am putting a document here? You see the 1, 2, 3, the three circles, the outer circle, the second circle, and then the middle circle with the A on it. This is just, you Google it. You can see the screen, right? Okay. So this is the symbol of the American Third Army. Now I'm going to go back to the screen share that we had before. Take a look at this. What are you looking at? Passover service, Munich Enclave, Munich, Germany, April 15th through 16th, 1946. The U.S. Army, that's our parents or grandparents who paid taxes to this country, non-Jews, Jews, they published a Passover Haggadah. A Passover Haggadah for the Seder, April 15th, 16th, 1946. It was put together by a man by the name of Scheinson, who was a Zionist. We could spend more time on this if we had. He got a Hungarian, another survivor. They put this together, both the text of it and the drawings of it. There are beautiful woodcuts. They're scary, but they're beautiful woodcuts in the Haggadah. You see what it says here on the top? Browse bad. What does it say in the beginning of the Haggadah? We open our Haggadah today and we say, Avodim Hayinu. We were slaves, Lepharo b'Mitzrayim. We were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt. What did the survivor, this is titled called the Survivor's Haggadah. What did the Survivor's Haggadah say in the opening? You see what it says here? We were slaves to Hitler in Germany. This was their experience of going from slavery to freedom. Avodim Hayinu. We were slaves. We were slaves to Hitler in Germany. And I think I actually left this in the office. I don't think I have it here. But you see in the illustrations of the Haggadah, you see what is this? These are men who are digging ditches for mass graves. And that's the ditch that he has here that's being dug in the middle, you could tell, with wheelbarrows. And it, under that is Avodim Hayinu Lepharo b'Mitzrayim. We were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt. Now look at this Dayenu that they wrote. This is wild. This is, it's hair-raising. Dayenu in our Haggadah is, had God not just taken us out of Egypt, it would have been enough. By the way, let me just pause it for 1 second. What does it mean, it would have been enough? It doesn't mean it would have been enough for God to have taken us out and left us at the steps of the Red Sea. It means it would have been enough to say thank you. There are 15 steps of Dayenu in the Seder. Dayenu means it would have been enough. Some of you are familiar with the song, Dayenu, Dayenu, right? So this song, Dayenu, it gives us 15 steps from God took us out of Egypt, then he gave us gave us the money from the Egyptians, he crossed over the Red Sea, he gave us food in the desert, he brought us to Sinai, gave us the Torah, all those things. Dayenu does not mean it would have been enough just to do step one. It would have been enough to say thank you. So I would just say parenthetically, thinking about our contemporary time and what we shouldn't and realize we can't take for granted, just to go out of our homes, just to go to the supermarket, to have people, you know, there are people, you know, who are, isolated from each other, to take camaraderie not for granted, to take technology for granted, not to take it for granted. The fact that we have the opportunity to get together over this video conference, some of us are alone at home, and the opportunity to see each other is so great. For some people, this is the first time they put on a shirt in a whole week. You know, they've been running around in suspenders and shorts. I don't know what's going on out there. It's a crazy world. So the opportunities that we have to say Dayen or to say thank you is very important. But how did they say in this very non-traditional Haggadah? The Haggadah goes, Dayenu, it would have been enough. Had he not given us the first crusade, would have been enough. Had he not given us blood libels, it would have been enough. Had he not given us the Black Plague, it would have been enough. Pogroms of Khmelnytsky, 1648, would have been enough. Hitler, but no ghettos, would have been enough. Gas chambers, like all these. And yet, all the more so, since they've befallen us, we must make Aliyah. Illegally wipe out the galut, the exile, build the chosen land, and make us some hope for ourselves and our children for eternity. Scheinson was an ardent Israeli Zionist, a modern Zionist, so his answer to the Dayenu of the persecutions was, make Aliyah. Fascinating. So we talked about, we should have done four. Passover is always in four. Oops. All right. We did threes. We did three observances of Passover. Well, there are three matzahs. So we got three matzahs, three observances of Passover on the train, in the war camp, and in the forest. Three Haggadahs. We got the Gur's Haggadah, the Beis Aharon Haggadah, and then the Survivor's Haggadah. And now we're going to do three Ask the Rabbi questions. Because one of the aspects, I mean, unless you're ready to go. If you're done, you can. The nice thing about this is you can sign off at any time. You don't have to walk out of the room. You just leave. If you're like, I can't handle this anymore, so you just press stop, and no one's going to hold it against you. And I don't even think that Wendy is going to penalize you for leaving early. I don't think she's going to toss you out of the museum. Well, Maury might get tossed out. If you leave early, I'm just telling you, I'm watching to make sure you don't leave. Oh. Now he laughs. Okay, we got a good laugh. You have to have a little humor. Oh, okay, Bill Page sends in a little text. Appreciation for everyone. Yeah, we thank God to be together. This Shevas Achim Gam Yachad, for having the opportunity to be together. So I want to go now to three Ask the Rabbis. I want to introduce you to three people. It's not just that they observed Passover, and it's not just that they wrote Haggadahs. Think about this for a second. Right now, in the Jewish community, there are unprecedented questions that are going on today, literally today, in my email that I see. I'm a member of the Rabbinical Council of America, which has over 1,000 rabbis. You're serving congregations across the world. And all kinds of questions are coming up because Jews, we are facing a Passover like we never had in our lifetime. I mean, people who are survivors of the Shoah had an exceptional Passover, but thank God I never had such a thing, and most of the people on this call never experienced this. Wait a second. What do we do today with social distancing? How do we prepare for Passover? So one of the things that oftentimes we do for Passover is that if we buy new utensils, we dip them, we immerse them in a mikvah. Well, what about people who are quarantined? They can't leave their home. And they buy a new utensil. They buy, let's say you're going to make a potato kugel for Pesach. I don't know. You're going to buy a new blender and it has a metal blade in it. And you're going to dip this, blade, this Cuisinart, whatever you're buying, new thing. You're going to dip it in a mikvah, in a special ritual bath. It's a gigantic, like a pool, like a bathtub type of pool with special water that came untouched from the rain. It's chlorinated, but some people are concerned to go to the mikvah. Well, how do you deal with that today? How do you prepare for Passover? What about if you have chametz, if you have leavened items in your home that you want to sell, but you're not going to go and meet the rabbi? Because usually what happens is we go and we ask the rabbi to find someone who's not Jewish and sell that chametz, that leavened item, that whiskey. The origin of selling chametz began with European Jews, because if you were a Jew in Poland, your economic spheres were very limited, so many Jews owned inns. You own an inn. How do you make money? You have a little tavern at the bottom of your inn, so you have a few barrels of whiskey. Well, if you were to throw out the whiskey, which is made out of wheat, anything which is made out of the five primary grains, wheat, rye, oats, spelt, and barley, any of those grains can cause something to become chametz. Well, if you're living in 1850 in Zmudzegrudz, or Zmudzegrudz, you know, just make up a name. No one will know the difference, just for this call. Not for the museum, just saying, just for this call. You're living out there. If you have to spill out all of your whiskey, you will have no food to put on your table. You will literally starve. So the rabbis came up with an idea of selling your whiskey to somebody who's not Jewish, because non-Jews are allowed to own chametz on Passover. But what about today? I'm not going to the rabbi to ask him to find a non-Jew to sell chametz to. And I'm not calling my non-Jewish neighbor either to say, come outside, I'd like to sell you my chametz. He doesn't want to buy my chametz today. He doesn't want to see me right now. And I can't even throw it to him because it's 6 feet away and my barrel of whiskey is so heavy. It's like, I can't. So what do you do? So today, rabbis are dealing with unprecedented questions. Literally today. Like, if I would have prepared this talk for you 3 weeks ago, or not 3 weeks ago, 6 weeks ago, I would have said, oh, it's theoretical. Rabbis have all kinds of interesting questions on Passover. Today, it is literally real. There are questions about, you know, I'm a firstborn. My son is a firstborn. There is a tradition, because the firstborns were spared on the night of Passover, that firstborns, there is a fast on the day before Passover. Erev Pesach, the day before Passover, it's a traditional firstborn fast. Well, if you have a celebratory meal where you finish a tractate of Talmud or something, you make a specific accomplishment, so you have what's called a siyum, you finish a tractate, you learn something, and you're going to celebrate, and then you don't have to fast. So usually what happens is, I would go to shul on the morning of the day before Passover, or I would make my own conclusion, I would learn my own thing, I go to shul, somebody brings cake, they bring schnapps, they don't bring it into shul because everybody gets neurotic, so it's Erev Pesach in the morning. I still remember as a kid, on the patio, there's a guy with a little glazel, a little thing of schnapps, and a little piece of cake, and everybody's sitting around, and all the firstborns eat. What do you do this year? No one's going to shul this year. There's no, so now you have to come up with Zoom siyums. Siyum on the Zoom, like all kinds of questions like we never heard of in our life. Well, now, if you go to the Holocaust, you take it to the next level. But what it shows is that the same way that today, in our day and age, people are committed to the observance of Passover to the extent that it's humanly possible, that's exactly the way that it was in the Holocaust. I want to introduce you now this man, Rabbi Ephraim Oshri. He authored a book called Responsa Mimamakim. This question that he has here is actually being dealt with today. Rabbi Ephraim Oshri was a rabbi in Kovno. So we know that when the Russians and the Germans split up Poland, so half of it went to the Russians, the eastern side, the western side went to the Germans. But then the Germans broke this deal in June of 1941. They start invading, and now by the summertime, they're up in Vilna and in Kovno, and they're massacring Jews right and left. They're establishing ghettos. So now they move in, and the Jews are quarantined, so to speak. They're trapped in the ghetto. Rabbi Oshri, the story of this responsa is for longer, because it's just incredible how he even wrote down these questions. He was a local rabbi, so people came to him with questions. I think that, to me, the fact that people asked these questions is extraordinary. The fact that it mattered to them. Why did it matter to them? Because this is their form of spiritual resistance, saying that even if the Germans can take away all of our surroundings, all of our food, of our family members, everything that we could possess physically, but they can't take away our Jewish identity. And we're going to resist by maintaining our Jewish identity. So Rabbi Oshri, in this volume, he says, "Bedin chametz bePesach b'soch haghetto." How to deal with chametz in the ghetto on Passover. Because he says, several questions were asked. And this is one of them. Imutar lechol kitnios, arbis, black arbis on Pesach, that the Tzor HaTzorer, the enemy, would distribute. What are arbis? Arbis are chickpeas. Think about this for a second. The Jews had almost nothing to eat. Technically speaking, as we'll see later, it was permitted, according to Jewish law, to even eat actual chametz. Actual bread is permitted because it's a life-saving measure. But Jews, so many righteous and pious Jews, they wanted to keep to the extent that they possibly physically could. And that means not only did they want to avoid eating chametz on Passover, there is an added stringency, which is traditional Ashkenazic Jews do not eat something called kitnios, legumes. So that would include corn, rice, other small beans, for two reasons. Either because sacks of grain used to be mixed up with sacks of legumes, so you would often have little pieces of corn or wheat mixed into each other's bags. So the fact that you bought rice, Sfardim eat rice, but Ashkenazim, I don't eat rice in my Seder. My family is from Poland, so we wouldn't eat rice. I've mentioned to many of the people on this call, don't eat rice on Passover. That would include arbis, these chickpeas. But that's just a minhag. It's just a custom. It's not a law. So now, says Rabbi Oshri, do you know what people were asking? They wanted to know if they should even be so strict not to eat the black beans. Amazing. That's how scrupulous people were. That's how sensitive they were, that they didn't want to give up even the added stringencies of Passover. He says, of course, it was permitted to eat the beans, and it was even permitted to eat chametz, which we'll talk about later, for life-saving purposes. But he even talks here about potato peels, in the cases where they had potatoes. You know, the idea of taking food and making it kosher for Pesach. So he quotes from Rav Avram Dov Ber Kahana, who was known as the Kovna Rav, the greatest rabbi of Kovna. He died before the Germans arrived, before the Germans exterminated them, just after, died a little after 1940. He said that Jews, you could take food, even if it was not Passover, kosher for Passover, like today, you can go to the supermarket and you can buy food that's clean, separate, kosher for Pesach. What if you had food that was just in your regular refrigerator? So maybe on a good year, you wouldn't use regular food, you would eat it up before Pesach, and then you would get new Passover food. He said, no, in this circumstance, you clean it off. But the fact that people cared, the fact that people were so committed, even if it meant sacrificing the little that they had left. Question, that was question number one. Here's question number two. I'll show it to you on the screen. It's going to be hard to read. Let's see. Where is it? Hold on. Here we go. So there was, some of us in this group have spoken about him. There was a great rabbinic scholar who lived in Chicago whose name was Reb Tzvi Hirsch Meisels. Reb Tzvi Hirsch Meisels was a rabbi in a Hungarian community called Weizen. After surviving Auschwitz, he was taken to Auschwitz in 1944, survives the war, comes to Chicago, and sets up shop, and he establishes a cheder. So today, there is actually a school here in West Rogers Park, Peterson Park. It's called Yeshiva Tiferes Tzvi, the beauty of Tzvi. Why is it called Tzvi? Because his name was Tzvi Hirsch Meisels. Hirsch is Yiddish for Tzvi. He, when he came to America, he wrote a volume that you're looking at on the screen. If you could see it, Mickey, can you give me a thumbs up if you can see the Mekadshei Hashem? Yes, thank you. So you're looking at a Hebrew volume, Shalos and Tshuvos, Responsa, Those Who Sanctify the Name of God. This is a collection of responsa of questions that people asked rabbis during the war. Now, what's interesting here is that he quotes not just questions that were asked to him, but questions that were asked to other rabbis who died in the Holocaust, whose memory he wants to perpetuate. He had colleagues who were in other Hungarian towns who got questions, so he wants to write them up. So you see on your screen, it's in Hebrew on the left side, he's writing a question that was sent to Reb Hananya Yom Tov Deitch, the Dayan, which means he was the judge, and the Moreh Tzedek, the rabbinic leader of Kehila Kedosha Davshina. So I don't know where Davshina is. I would have to look on Google Maps. It's some tiny town in Hungary. And he says people were asking what they should do in their community connected with a similar question which came to the Av Bezit of Nitra. We'll talk about it in a second. Regarding using flour for baking matzah. Usually, to bake matzah today, if you go to the store and you buy matzah, you're going to have matzah, which is matzah shemura, matzah which is guarded. What is it guarded from? It's guarded from becoming chametz, from becoming leaven. The minute that you take flour and mix it with water, that starts the clock that it can become chametz. So the best kind of matzah is matzah, which is what we call shemura, guarded, mishas ketzira, from the time of harvest. So if I went upstairs and went to the pantry where we bought matzah yesterday, or I bought new matzah yesterday, I bought some more last week, most of the handmade matzah you'll get, and some of the machine matzah, is extra watched all the way from the time of harvesting. That means that someone, meaning usually a rabbi or mashgiach, went to a field where there was a combine, where they harvested wheat and they made it into grain. They just took off the chaff. They made it into grain and pounded it and crushed it and blended it up into wheat. Somebody watched it the entire time. Now today, we have other kinds of matzahs, which is shmura. It's guarded from the time that you mixed water into the flour in the plant where you actually bake the matzah. That's called shmura mishas lisha, from the time of mixing, from the time of kneading. Two kinds of kneading. So one is called watching from the time of harvesting. The other one is watching from the time of kneading. And so what they are discussing here in this question, which was raised with the chief rabbi of Nitra, was how stringent do they need to be? This is in Chaf Nisan, Chaf or Beis, I can't even tell, Tuf Shin Gimel, 1943, when they're thinking about how to bake matzah. How to deal with the fact that today, he says in Nisan in 1943, they don't have the ability to have people going out to the field to watch the harvest like they did in previous years. So is it okay to use regular flour? What if the flour has been bleached? Why is it, you're thinking to yourself, why is it that I can't just go to the store and buy flour and use it in my kitchen today? Because the answer is because the flour was bleached. It was washed already. The minute the flour was washed, the kernels were washed, it could become chametz, it could become leavened. So they're trying to figure out how to navigate buying flour to bake matzah in 1943 with limited flour. What level of stringency do they need to use? He introduces here the Nitra Rav. There is an important book on the religious resistance from rabbis who were trying to rescue other Jews in Slovakia. This, the Nitra Rav, this rabbi who did not survive the war, but was very influential in negotiating with Germans and Czech authorities, his fingerprints are found in different places in our Holocaust studies. This rabbi of Nitra, the Nitra Hasidus, although he did not survive the war, it was reconstituted in Mount Kisco in New York. So question number one was for Rabbi Oshri in Kovno about kitniot, using beans, eating beans on the Seder. The second question was for Rabbi Deitch about what kind of flour to use. The third question is here from, where is it? Here it is. This is from, and I want to see if you can tell me if you can see this now. Here we go. Can you see the new screen that just popped up? It says the word Shehechianu. You see it. Okay. So this is from the Rabbi Aronson volume that we mentioned before, that Rabbi Aronson was in this work camp called Kunin in Poland with a group, and they says they had a Haggadah. And there was a question asked at this Seder, a very powerful question. I'm going to read it for you in the Hebrew. The Haggadah, the Hebrew is on the screen, but I'm just going to summarize it. He says they had a Haggadah that they were going to, quote-unquote, read. So they had, in this work camp, they had wine, they had candles, they had an egg, they even had charosas and a little bit of maror that they scrapped together. He said they had the Haggadah, and they said the Haggadah together. When Rabbi Aronson finished saying Kiddush, this is firsthand testimony about himself. We got after Kiddush, which is the blessing that we open, we herald the holiday with sanctifying this time. We recite the bracha of Shehechianu, that God has kept us alive to live at this time. And he says, we began to say it, and we all cried. He says, we cried for a half hour. We just sat there and cried at the Seder in Kunin in this barrack for a half hour. And he says, then I, the rabbi, asked a question. I asked a question. I asked myself a question. Isn't this what we call a bracha levatala, a blessing in vain? Who can say the blessing, Shehechianu v'kiyumanu v'hegiyanu lazman hazeh? Which, by the way, even if we're going to be alone at this Seder, unfortunately, I think there are going to be some people who are going to be making the Seder alone by themselves in their homes or apartments. We're thinking of you, those of us who are together with others, just to say that God brought us to this time, that we're healthy. We can make a Seder alone in our apartment. That's going to be difficult, but it's something we have to do. He says, isn't this a bracha levatala? Isn't this a wasted blessing? How can you say, says Rabbi Aronson, Shehechianu, thank God for bringing us to this time. Look where we are. He says, the answer is in the next portion of the Haggadah. We say that we remember Egypt in two periods. Yemei Chayecha, the days of your life, and the rabbis taught in the Haggadah, Kol Yemei Chayecha. You're going to find this toward the beginning of the Maggid section of the Haggadah. Yemei Chayecha, the days of your life, days, says Rabbi Aaronson, the Haggadah says, those are the days. Kol, all the days of your life, Kol Yemei Chayecha, Halelos, the nights. He says, we say the Haggadah, we remember God, we live with God, we are thankful for the ability to be existing, and we recognize that God took us out of Egypt and will save us one day, even the Lalila, even at night. How can we say the blessing of bringing us to this day when we're isolated in our homes? Obviously, thank God we're not in the Kunin work camp. Lo Elena, we're not in a death camp or an internment camp. We're not in Westerbork or Bergen-Belsen, God forbid. But we can still be thankful for what we have. And that tradition of being thankful, even if we are balelos, even if we are at night, in the nighttime of life when it's challenging, we can still thank God for what we have and for the idea that we will be redeemed and we've been redeemed before. I'm going to close with one item that I want to share with you. So we talked about three seders, three observances of Pesach, three Haggadahs, three ask the rabbis questions, kitnias, flour, and blessings. I want to close with one incredible artifact. Can you see this on your screen? Avi, I see you. Avi, can you give me a thumbs up if you could see this section on your screen? Yes. Great. This is unbelievable. We once had a class, we once discussed the rabbis of the Netherlands. There were, I believe, 11 chief rabbis, including Rabbi Aaron Yisachar Davids, and there was a very prominent, we could do a whole session just on the background of this one scrap of paper that you have in front of you. The group of rabbis from, and most of the Dutch Jewish community, over 100,000 Jews, they were taken to a transit camp in the Netherlands called Westerbork, and then they were sent one of two places, either straight to Auschwitz or to Bergen-Belsen. In 1944, there was a group of rabbis who were in Bergen-Belsen preparing for Passover, several of these Dutch rabbis. They did not survive the war, but this scrap of paper that they wrote did survive the war. I'm going to read what it says on this paper with a free English translation, and we're going to understand how what this means is the ultimate in spiritual resistance on every level. Not just spiritual resistance in a vacuum of being committed to observing a Torah, spiritual, orthodox, traditional life, but within that life at the highest level. It says the following. Keeping in mind who's writing this, these rabbis from Amsterdam, from the Netherlands, and who their audience is, Bergen-Belsen, 1944. Lefnei achilas chametz, before eating chametz, yomer bekavanas halev. On Passover, before we eat chametz, said the rabbis, we should say the following blessing, the following prayer. Reminder, you're not allowed to eat chametz on Passover. It says, Avinu shebashamayim, our Father in heaven. Hine behold, goloi v'yadua lefanecha. It is revealed and known to you, God, sheritzonenu, that our wish, lasos ritzoncha, to do your wish. V'lochog, and to observe, eschag ha-pesach, the holiday of Passover, ba'achilas matzah, by eating matzah, u'bishmiras, and observing iser chametz, the prohibition of eating chametz. Ach, however, alzos, on this, doava libenu, our heart is broken. Shehashibud, that the slavery, Bergen-Belsen, 1944, the Passover slavery, ma'akivosanu, it impedes us, va'anachnu nimtzaim, we are found, besakonas nefashos, in a situation of life and death. So what do Jews do when it's facing life and death? They have to live. It's a mitzvah, it's a commandment from God, v'chai b'hem. They should live. Hinenu muchanim umezumanim. We are now preparing and designating ourselves, which is, this phrase is taken from the Hasidic tradition. Before we do any mitzvah, we say we're preparing to do this. L'kayim mitzvascha, to fulfill your commandment, v'chai b'hem. By eating chametz, we are going to fulfill the commandment of God to live. Lizoyer, to be careful, v'lizoyer, and to be careful, me'azharascha, from your God, your commandment, hishomer lecha u'shmor nafshecha me'od, protect your health as much as you can. So we're not abrogating our relationship with God by eating chametz on Pesach. We are keeping it. Al kein, therefore, tfilaseinu lecha, our prayer to you, God, shetechayenu, you should keep us alive. Utekaimenu, and keep us standing. Usegalenu, and you should redeem us b'mehera. Why? Why should you redeem us quickly? Lishmor chukecha, so that we can go back to observing your laws. V'lasos ritzoncha, and to do your wishes, God. Ula'avdecha b'lev av shalem, and we should serve God with a full heart. Yes. Yeah. Okay, let me catch that. So I'm going to stop the share. So now you can see this scrap of paper was found in Bergen-Belsen after the war. Question coming in from the chat. Hang on, let me see what it says. How did people get paper, ink in a work camp? Maybe I missed it. So the answer is that, that when we say the word camp, we mean a whole host of different things. We know there were death camps, there were concentration camps, labor camps. There were internment camps, there were transit camps, and in each one of these places, there were different circumstances. So various people had underground smuggling enterprises going on. So there were places where, you know, in maybe in one extreme, you could even talk about people who had some kind of quasi, almost like a normal life. The Sonderkommando, they actually had... they had mattresses, they had beds, they had some kind of normal-ish, not really normal, of course, but so depending on the camp where you were, there was a whole underground smuggling situation where different people had. So, for example, in the Conan work camp, they actually were able to get wine. In other places, they had potato peels. The Bluja Forever talks about how Hanukkah, they got together some grease that they used from their boots. So different situations, they had a different access to different things. So in some places, they actually did have access. So for example, we started with Sophie Solberg in the laundromat in Auschwitz. So she had access to paper and pen. Well, that's how she made her calendar. So different people had different levels of access to different things. So to summarize, and this is what we will... I'm happy to share any of these materials and all of them with you. To summarize, this is the... Let me go back to the... I'll share with you the outline of our talk from today. We started with defining freedom and the teaching of Rav Kook and the notion that freedom is being true to yourself. So for Jews, this meant a connection and a commitment of continuity of spiritual life in whatever form it was possible during the Passover holiday. We gave three examples of the observance of Passover. You see that in section 2. We gave three examples of Haggadahs from the Holocaust, three examples of Ask the Rabbi questions, and then the prayer for eating chametz on Pesach, which is, again, that level of commitment to making sure that even when they had to compromise their religious convictions, even when they couldn't observe Pesach in the way that they wanted to, but they could still remain connected to God. They could still be serving God even when violating Pesach. Because that acceptance of God's part of their life and the requirement to stay alive from a Jewish and spiritual standpoint, that mandated that eating chametz constituted a mitzvah, and that too they were able to do even in these most dire circumstances. They were able to keep that connection with God even in this indescribable circumstance of Bergen-Belsen. I can't imagine a more... inspiring perspective than people who are committed to God and eating chametz as a mitzvah. So today, we in the challenge, which pales obviously into comparison to what these people experience, but we're going to be facing a challenging Passover in different ways. We can always come back to that internal soul, to that experience of who are we and what are we. We are a soul, a spark of godliness. Whether we're Jewish or not Jewish, this is the time of freedom that we are, as Jews, are modeling for the world. It's an opportunity to appreciate what we have, to think about Dayenu, and to make sure that we really maintain that continuity, that connection to the heritage which was given to us, and make sure that we pass it to the next generation, which is the experiential education that we're providing at the Seder, whether we're alone and we reinforce that for ourselves, or where we are with others. I cannot thank you enough for spending the morning together. I hope you're going to stay well, stay healthy, take care of yourselves. I look forward